Hi, I'm Michael Senoff, founder and CEO of HardToFindSeminars.com. For the last 5 years, I've interviewed the world's best business and marketing minds. Along the way, I've created a successful publishing business all from home from my two-car garage. When my first child was born, he was very sick, and it was then that I knew I had to have a business that I could operate from home. Now my challenge is to build the world's largest free resource for online downloadable MP3 audio business interviews. I knew I needed a site that contained strategies, solutions, and inside angles to help you live better, to save and make more money, to stay healthier, and to get more out of life. I've learned a lot in the last 5 years, and today I'm going to show you the skills you need to survive.
John Sauerkist, he used to be a fairly high-ranking person at Walmart. He one time said, selling to Walmart is not a difficult process. It's pretty straightforward. And really it is. And it's a lot of stuff that you have to learn. But once you learn it, regardless of what product you're carrying, you're probably going to be successful. I love to think you're going to be successful. And that's why we do what we do. Getting a product into Walmart or any of these large mass merchandisers is like winning the lottery to an entrepreneur or a product developer. I want to shed some light onto the reality of this subject, and obviously it's been done before because Walmart is filled with products, but I want you, through your experience, to talk about your trials and tribulations and your frustrations and your successes and how you did it, and maybe someone listening to this, it can give them a more realistic view of how to do it and things to avoid, and we'll just kind of talk about your story.
Okay.
So how did you, Lonnie, start in all this? Give me the genesis of even being an entrepreneur. Were you an employee for someone before you got into trying to get your own stuff into Walmart?
Well, yeah, I've been involved in consumer packaged goods now for about 22 years.
So explain, what is a consumer packaged good?
Consumer packaged goods is companies that manufacture items for resale. When you think of CPG, that's what we abbreviate as CPG manufacturing. We're thinking of people like Procter & Gamble, Unilever, General Mills, Quaker, Pepsi-Cola, or PepsiCo, that's a CPG company as well.
Because I'm thinking Coca-Cola, cereals, soaps, things like that. What about Procter & Gamble?
Procter & Gamble is a consumer packaged goods company without a doubt, yes. As a matter of fact, ironically, I started my career with Procter & Gamble years ago back in the early 80s, covering a pretty diverse territory for them. So that's kind of where I got started into the business.
As a sales rep?
As a sales rep, yes.
What were you selling, their whole line?
No, really, Procter & Gamble at the time had 7 divisions, and the division that I worked for was bar soap and household cleaning products. So I sold the soaps like Coast and Zest and Ivory, and the household cleaning products like Downy and Mr. Clean, Top Job. Now, there was also a division that sold packaged soaps and detergents, so I wasn't a part of that division. I was part of the other division that complemented that. And then, of course, it had 6 other divisions besides those 2.
So what was your job with them?
Sales rep. And so what I did was I walked into retailers, and I would call on retail outlets. And back in the days that I started, there were still a lot of independent grocers left around. So you call on independent grocers, you really got a better understanding of how grocery worked, because these guys that you called on, Michael, were responsible for everything. They're responsible for their entire P&L, their entire family's livelihood, relied upon them doing well in grocery.
And there's very small margins in the grocery business.
Oh, we used to call them razor thin. We had this little deal where we used to go out and we took a dollar bill and we would mark this dollar bill off based upon how much money went where for the retailer. And in terms of profits, we had less than a penny marked off on the dollar bill.
Per dollar?
Per dollar, yeah.
So it's like 1% profit.
So you're looking at about 1% is what they're actually getting at the end of the day. Even though they work on higher margins, at the end of the day, they're getting about 1 penny out of every dollar goes towards profits. That's the way it was back then. And now, of course, with the new bigger retailers like Walmart, it might even be less.
So what did you learn by calling on the independents? What is it you learned from them that made it valuable for today?
Number one, you understand the whole grocery business, the whole supply chain. You understand where it starts, where the whole life cycle starts out in the field. And you also learn how it gets into the stores, how to mark up, what kind of margins they're operating on, different types of overhead, for instance, labor and things of that nature. What's the greatest amount of overhead? I guess the biggest thing you learn is how to be a retailer. For instance, at a chain store, you only see one side of it. At an independent store where the person owns it, you see everything. When you would meet with an independent owner, you met with not only the person that was in charge of marketing, You met with the person that was in charge of operations. You met with the human resources manager and everything in that one individual. And so you learned a lot about the business calling on independents back then. Now they've all gone along the wayside. There's not a lot of independent grocers left anymore. There's very few. They've been eaten up by the chains.
Just gone out of business.
Well, yeah. There's a lot of negative press out there now on Walmart in terms of what they've done to the independent grocer. But I think all chains have that responsibility as well, because when I started calling on back in the 80s, Walmart didn't have a super center, but independent grocers were going out of business left and right, and Walmart wasn't around at that point. So it's just the evolution of the business. It's not just about Walmart. These chain operators can do it bigger. They're more efficient. They have bigger buying power than mom-and-pop grocery stores.
All right, working for Procter & Gamble, they're a huge company. Do they have influence that gave them a huge edge, even to get into the independent and even the mass merchandisers, that the small guy, the guys with a dream and a product who want to try and get in, the little guy? I mean, obviously, how can a little guy compete with such a powerful force like Procter & Gamble?
That's always been a source of contention for a lot of folk as well when they dealt with big companies. Procter & Gamble never had much influence, as much so as they had excellent products.
So they really were a great product company.
Oh, without a doubt. Procter & Gamble, they were very cautious. They were very measured about how they did things. And when they came out with new items, you better believe that it had been tested and tested and tested and tested again, to the point where it almost ended up, Michael, being a detriment to Procter & Gamble. There's this old story about Procter & Gamble and Love's, or Pampers, I'm not real sure which one it was, and how Procter & Gamble was a leader in the market and how Huggies took that, because if you look on the side of a diaper, it has those little sticky things that stick. Procter & Gamble was scared that little tiny plastic piece that came off of the adhesive piece. They wanted to make sure no kids would choke on it. They tested and retested. In the meantime, Huggies, Kimberly Clark, rolled out with theirs, and boom. So they were able to take advantage of that. And so the whole idea behind test markets, which was a solid proposition, started to go away as well, because it's like, look, if we want to get our product to market fast, we don't have time to test market it. We need to get it out into the stores.
All right, what did you do after working for Procter & Gamble?
After Procter & Gamble, I went and I worked for Frito-Lay, which is a division of PepsiCo. There are essentially two types of distribution methods in consumer packaged goods. There's warehouse, where the product is made by the company to ship through warehouse and ship to the customer's warehouse and then out to the customer's stores.
I want to back up so I understand. So would this fall into the category for Frito-Lay?
No.
Would that fall in the category for what Procter & Gamble was doing?
That would fall in the category for Procter & Gamble.
Okay, so give me an example.
Well, first of all, Procter & Gamble manufactured the soap in their manufacturing facility, okay? So there's a case of soap. Now, a customer would place an order for a case of soap.
And a customer could be a chain of grocery stores.
In the grocery stores, right. They would place an order and say, send me a truckload of this soap. So, for instance, that purchase order would go to their order processing area. The order would be processed, the truck would be loaded, and the truck would go directly to the customer's warehouse, where it would be loaded and slotted into the warehouse.
And then it's distributed to their stores from the warehouse.
That's what we call warehouse. Now, the other delivery system is called direct store delivery, and we abbreviate that as DSD. And what direct store delivery does, for instance, let's go with Frito-Lay. Frito-Lay manufactures their chips. They fry their chips, and they put them in bags. Instead of putting them in cases and shipping those cases directly to the customer's warehouse, they put those chips on the back of trucks, and the Frito-Lay delivery person goes out to the store every day and delivers the chips directly to the store. And that's what we call DSD. And you can see that when you go to the stores in the morning, you'll see a lot of bread trucks, a lot of Frito trucks, a lot of cake trucks, and even some frozen food trucks delivering right there that morning.
Is that a necessity because of the short lifespan of the product, or why do we see some products delivered that way directly to the stores compared to warehouse? Why won't they just ship to warehouse and let the stores do their own distribution?
The reason they don't do that is, again, just like you said, it's part of that perishable nature of the product. You probably got a point with Frito-Lay, because with Frito-Lay, their product has 60 to 90-day shelf life on it. You could literally take that through most warehouses and not lose. But the direct store delivery piece that Frito-Lay has put in place enables Frito-Lay to always make sure that their product's on the shelf, they're touching their product every day.
They're going in looking at their shelf space.
Right.
They're making sure it looks neat, their display,
exactly.
Their point of purchase.
Now, you take a company like Walmart, they have such an efficient supply chain, they could literally take that through the warehouse and probably do just about as good a job getting it to the stores as the DSD guys. The problem you have, though, is once it gets to the stores, who's going to touch it? And so that's where the DSD guys, they will fight going through the warehouse tooth and nail.
so they don't want to go through a warehouse because they know that's going to hurt their sales in the long run.
Yeah, I think they know that. The major companies know that. They think it'll hurt their sales.
That's what sales reps for Frito-Lay, they've got people in areas delivering and touching that product and making sure it's displayed properly or new promotions are done to help move it off the shelf.
Right, and if they didn't do that, then someone in the store would have to do that.
And it never gets done. You can't rely on that employee.
Frito-Lay has a wonderful model. When I used to work for them, they used to brag about a 98% customer service ratio every day. That's phenomenal. Anyone can get a service level at 98% every day.
Okay, so with Frito-Lay, what were you doing there?
I worked on their systems, and I worked in an area called category management. And from the system standpoint, I was helping them understand how to leverage data to sell product. That's the bottom line.
How to leverage data to sell product.
Right, and then by doing so, how could we package that data and deliver that to the salespeople? And so we would build a software program to deliver that sales data to the salesperson out in the field, who in turn would deliver it to their customer in a value-added way. And I also did their category management piece. Now, what category management is was simply a big push back in the mid-90s to early 90s, and it's even still around, where you're focused more on the category than an individual brand.
What does that mean?
Say, for instance, you want to do a promotion on Tide. You give all this money to do this promotion on Tide. You sell Tide at such a crazy price that you look at your category at the end of the day and you lost money in your category, right?
And your category is what, the laundry detergent?
The laundry detergent category, right. So what retailers start to say is, wait a minute, you guys are coming in and you're managing your brands, but you're not managing the category. It's got to be our responsibility to manage the category. So if there's a brand that pulls the overall profitability and sales of the category down, we need to make sure that we have the right type of promotions, the right type of product mix and everything to ensure that that does not happen.
So does that mean if they come in and run a real low price or a coupon on Tide, then everyone comes in and buys the Tide, but they don't buy the other soaps in the category at the grocery store, and that hurts their sales?
That's irresponsible category management, yes. Will hurt their sales.
And the grocery stores don't want that.
Well, I wouldn't think so. I wouldn't want my category to lose money. You know, you could say, well, the money that Tide gave you to run the promotion should offset any losses. No, that's not the case. Because every day when you sell Tide, you also sell another product. At full revenue, you're selling Tide at full revenue. You're also selling other people's product at full revenue as well. So when you deal Tide, yeah, you're going to sell more Tide, but you're going to lose those full revenues. Sales of other people someone would have bought, but they said, well, I can't pass up this deal on Tide. And so you'll lose some revenue that way. Although there's a twist to that, which we'll talk about in a minute when we talk about Walmart, but the whole category management piece is, look, manage the health of the category. Don't just manage individual brands in the category. And really, that's the way even buyers had managed and merchandisers had managed the category previous to category management.
So that's important for buyers when they're looking at products is to understand, is this product going to help my category, rather than just looking at a product sales focus.
Right, and here's an important point, Michael. Category management enables the small manufacturer or the small guy with the great idea to be able to compete with the big boys. Because what it does, it says this product might be right for your category. Now, it might not be right for all your grocery stores, or it might not be right for all your chain stores or your discount stores, but it could be right for 10 of them.
It could be an add-on to a category that bumps up profits.
Exactly. It could serve a need in that category.
Okay, so if you have a product that you're asking yourself, is there potential for Walmart or a large mass merchandiser? Ask yourself this question, could my product help the overall category, and can I use that as a selling benefit when I get in to talk to a buyer?
Oh, exactly.
That's something I never even realized.
Exactly. I tell people, whenever they want to get a new item anywhere, I don't care what store they want to get it in, I don't care if it's a small independent grocery down the street and they just want to make the product for that one store. So before you even approach that store, you go in and you know everything about that store and you know everything about that category you want to go in.
How would you suggest I do homework on that? Let's say I have a product and I want to get into a store. What would you tell me to do to go do my research? Go down to the physical store?
It all starts with going to the store. It all starts right there. The first thing you always want to do is make sure there is a glaring need that is not being met by the products that are currently in the category. And if you can prove there's a glaring need that's not being met that products in the category, you're going to be successful somewhere down the line. It's going to take hard work, but you're still going to be successful. And don't tell me yours tastes better, because everybody's product tastes better. Everybody's products perform better. Everybody's product lasts longer. Those are things that buyers get tired of hearing every day.
They want to hear unique selling benefit.
There it is right there, that USP, the unique selling proposition. They really do want to hear that. They want you to give them compelling reasons. Buyers don't really want to say no.
They want reasons to say yes.
Yeah. I read a long time ago from a guy named Jeff Fox. He wrote a bunch of books, one called How to Be a Rainmaker, How to Be a Marketing Superstar, and he said buyers don't buy buy products. They buy what products can do for them, which is very important. It's almost personal. I tell people all the time, look, buyers don't always buy the best tasting product. My case in point is go to any store and start taking product off the shelf and eat it. Some of that stuff tastes so bad you want to throw up. Buyers buy what products can do for them. And by them, they mean what it can do for their bottom line, for their store. Does it meet a compelling need? Does it meet a glaring need that's not being met currently based on the product?
How about for their ego? There's a way to sell a buyer, and a buyer has ulterior motives. They want advancement. They want the star product. They want recognition. Can you give me the psychology of a buyer?
Well, again, it gets back to that statement. Buyers don't buy products. They buy what products can do for them.
So, you know, if a buyer comes across a super product that just really kicks ass in the store, what can that do for a buyer's career?
You understand that. You're measured by the overall category gross margin, your overall category profitability. There's a number of factors that you're measured by.
So buyers are constantly measured by their numbers.
Oh, yeah, without a doubt, because, again, you've got a sales budget, and if you don't meet that sales budget, you've got a problem, because it all rolls up to that overall budget, which says this is what we're going to do as an organization for this year. And so you've got your goals that you have to reach. Every buyer waits for that one product to come in the door and say, wow, this is going to take me to fame and fortune. You never know what it is. I mean, we'll talk later about some examples with Walmart where they have a program called the VPI program, which used to be a program called the Volume Producing Items.
Is that a program for buyers?
That's a program for buyers. That's a program for store level. That's a program for everybody at Walmart that is in some type of capacity that touches product and have a VPI.
Because they want that whole company looking for the next star product.
Well, without a doubt. That was all Sam Walton and his genius.
Tell me what can happen to a buyer if he finds that product. Let's say he finds that star product that catapults huge sales for Walmart worldwide or nationally or whatever. Is he paid a commission on gross revenues if he's the guy who found that product? What kind of incentives are there for him in volume-wise to really keep an eye out for good products?
Pretty much every buyer that I've ever called on has the bonus potential. And so what it relates to is if they get certain criteria, they're going to make additional monies. They're going to get a bonus based upon what they did. And so that's why they're always on the lookout for that product as well, because it's going to mean money to them. Now, there's a cap to what they're going to make. It's not going to be infinite, no. But they're still going to be able to make their max bonus, for instance, if they have the right item and their numbers actually hit, you know, whatever that scorecard has down there.
My father used to tell me never write a buyer's name down in pen because they're always moving around. Always do it in pencil. What's the lifespan of a buyer?
It just depends. With my experience at Walmart, in one of the categories that I called on over the last 6 years, I've had 10 buyers. So 10 buyers in 6 years, that's less than a year.
And where do they go?
They go on, they move up, or they move out.
They move up to different categories?
No, they move up to the same category or promotion within a different category, or they move out, meaning they move could be to a different category or out of the company.
What's the hierarchy, the levels of a buyer? Start from the lowest to the highest. How does it work? Is everything broken down into categories, though?
Well, yeah, it really varies, too. A buyer is also called category manager. So you've got that. Below them, you've got an assistant buyer or assistant category manager. So you've got the buyer. Then you go up from the buyer, you've got a senior buyer, and then you can go up to a variety of positions from there. You know, head of grocery merchandising or vice president of perishables. It just depends. I think Kroger years ago used to have their buyers, and then the buyers would actually go out and work the stores and run stores at a certain point. And
so are the buyers the ones meeting with the sales reps, or are the assistants buyers doing that?
No, the buyers are meeting with the sales reps, yeah.
And the assistants are supporting the buyers, administrative or what have you.
And sometimes they'll meet with reps, too.
So does the buyer have to get approval from who's above him?
No.
All buyers have decision-making abilities.
They have decision-making ability. However, there are some organizations that have a buying committee, and someone comes in with a new product, they present that to the buyer, and then the buyer in turn goes and presents that to the buying committee.
So they have meetings every week?
Right, every Friday or every Monday, it just depends. And the buying committee makes a determination if that is a good product and it should be brought into the company. But a company like Walmart, you can't have a buying committee meet every week, although they do have their weekly meetings on Friday. And they do have a Saturday morning meeting, you know, a lot of good ideas, and they share, you know, a new buyer's not going to buy something without getting a go-ahead from their boss, but many buyers bought from me right there on the spot.
Well, I want to go back a little bit. What happened after Frito-Lay?
I did some consulting for a little bit with IBM, business and retail and consumer packaged goods manufacturing.
Because you had gained a lot of experience with your years in Procter & Gamble and Frito-Lay?
Oh, without a doubt. Yes.
How many years total between the two?
11 years.
So why'd you end Frito-Lay? You're just tired of it?
I'm just tired, yeah. But to move on to at least what I thought was better opportunity.
All right, so you got into consulting?
Yeah, I got into consulting for a couple of years.
And what were you doing in that? You were helping?
Retailers and manufacturers, mostly retailers, help them become profitable and look at their categories, make sure they had efficient processes and procedures in place, and all those types of things. it was kind of interesting. A lot of manual, hard work, a lot of documentation, documenting processes and procedures. It wasn't very glamorous, but I think it's something that really gives you a solid base to go out and do other things.
Where were you seeing the most common mistakes among the retailers you were consulting with? And would that shed any light for opportunity for me getting my product into them?
Oh, yeah. The most common mistake that I saw with retailers is they didn't know how to buy.
They didn't know what was going to sell.
Well, they kind of had an idea, but they just didn't know how. Let me give you a good example. I did an engagement one time with a beverage company on the eastern coast.
Well, what does an engagement mean?
A consulting gig.
Okay.
I did this with a beverage company on the east coast. And this company had done like $5 million in sales.
What were they selling?
They were selling alcoholic beverage items, microbrews, wine, those types of things. And they made $5 million in sales and lost $10 million. It was just such a disparity between their profitability and their overall sales that it wasn't even funny in terms of how much money they lost. And they were, we don't know why we're losing all this money, right? So I started talking to some of the buyers, and here's a few examples I ran across.
These were people who bought their beverage, right?
Yeah, they bought for those stores. You see what I'm saying?
You were consulting with a beverage company, but you were talking to buyers of these alcoholic beverages.
This was a retail beverage outlet. It's just like calling on a regular buyer for groceries.
Okay, I'm with you.
And so they were buying all these beverage products from around the world, not around the country, but from around the world. And here's two glaring mistakes I saw one buyer make. One buyer was talking about Coca-Cola. And we were sitting there talking, and I found out he had a warehouse full of Coke. And I said, why do you have a warehouse full of Coke? He said, because it was such a good deal, I couldn't pass it up. I said, well, let me get this right. You're using warehouse space on a direct store delivery product? And he said, yeah, it was a great deal. And I'm like, well, it's direct store delivery. You don't need to forward buy on direct store delivery. What he was doing was forward buying on direct store delivery at this great deal. He thought it was a great deal. And it really wasn't, because beverage items, I can go back in 1982, when 2 liters were introduced at around that time frame, I could buy a 2 liter for 99 cents. Guess what, Michael? It's 2006. I can still buy a 2 liter for 99 cents. He got someone that sold him what he thought was a great deal. And I think ultimately it hurt the person who sold it to him as well, because it's showing you're not thinking for the future. The second one is there are these vineyards around the world. And what these guys would do is they distill wine. They'd bottle this wine, and it would be a limited run. Well, what these guys would do is they found out it would be a limited run, and they'd go and they'd buy all the inventory. Not knowing if they were going to sell it or not, they'd just buy it so their competitors wouldn't get it.
So they were making poor business decisions.
They were making very poor business decisions. So when I went in, there were $200-$300 bottles of wine on the shelf that were not going to move. And contrary to popular belief, all wine is not good aged. And so we had to have a fire sale. And when I talked to the buyer about it, he says, well, you don't understand wine. We buy from passion. And I said, and you don't understand business. It's okay to have passion for the business, but if you're buying based on passion and not based on the numbers, well, you got a problem.
So were you able to help these guys out?
No, we helped them out. It was a few of us, and we spent around 6 months just helping them out, and apparently they returned the profitability. I went on with different things, but the bottom line is, in this business, if you're really not a good business person and you really don't understand the category that you're calling on or that you're buying, and you really don't understand what your overall goals are, your objectives, you're going to have problems.
All right, so you did the consulting for 2 years, and then what?
And then I just have a variety of different jobs, but more importantly, I worked for a tortilla company for 6 years. And with that tortilla company, it's when I got most of my Walmart experience. The first time I called on Walmart was back in about 1993.
Was your capacity as a sales rep?
You could call me a sales rep. Actually, I was a team leader, and I built a team of people at Walmart. But the bottom line is, when I took over the Walmart business, the company nationally had done around $500,000 with Walmart. When I left that company a year ago, they did $120 million.
Were these soft flour tortillas or crunchy?
These were flour and corn tortillas, yeah.
Okay.
So the bottom line is, you take a niche product and you can build that niche product to a $120 million business.
So was it geographical or were you going national?
National. I called on Walmart headquarters and built a team up there.
All right, so let's do the story. This was your first experience getting into Walmart. You were representing flour tortillas.
No, my first experience getting into Walmart goes back to Frito-Lay.
You want to talk about that success?
Yeah. Frito-Lay actually had a small warehouse business. And if I'm not mistaken, they were trying to leverage their Taco Bell line at the time. You know, Frito-Lay was part of PepsiCo, who at the time, back in the early 90s, owned Taco Bell, Kentucky Fried Chicken, and Pizza Hut. So they were trying to leverage their Taco Bell line, which they had taken the Taco Bell name and had put it on some tacos, and they boxed them to be sold through the warehouse. And I accompanied a young man up there. Back then, we flew into Fayetteville. Nowadays, Walmart has built a pretty nice airport in northwest Arkansas. They have direct flights in daily from a number of cities around the country. But when I flew in, we were still flying on prop planes to Fayetteville, Arkansas, which they have a little airport there. And we went to meet, and that was my first experience with him, and that's where I really understood when we met with a kid that looked like he had been out of high school for 2 days.
And he was the buyer.
And he was the buyer.
What year was this?
This was back in 1993. We flew into Fayetteville, Arkansas.
And what's the city like? I mean, was it built up at all there?
No, back then it wasn't that built up, but it was getting there.
And so this is Walmart's headquarters.
Yeah, Walmart is headquartered in Bentonville, Arkansas. And Bentonville is a part of a metropolitan area in northwest Arkansas that includes Fayetteville, Springdale, Bentonville, obviously, and then there's some smaller communities, Asylum Springs, that are all part of that metropolitan area. And so anyways, we flew into there, and it was that same day in, same day out, because we were flying out of Dallas. We flew in and went to meet with the Walmart buyer. He looked like, I said, 2 or 3 days out of high school, but when this kid opened his mouth, I found out he was very intelligent. We threw our proposition out there, and that's where he broke in. He said, look, okay, number one, you've come in here with an item. Have you even bothered to go visit the category? You know how much space I have in the category? Will this product even fit in the category? How am I going to price this product? What differentiates this product from any other taco shell that we have on the shelf? Why is your product better? He really came after these guys, and he told them, and I was the category manager representing them at the time, and he told us all, he said, listen, get your act together and try it again. And so that was the end of the meeting.
But those buyers, they're saying, come and sell me your product and tell me why and how I can do it, and we'll do it.
Don Soderkist, he used to be a fairly high-ranking person at Walmart. He one time said, selling to Walmart is not a difficult process. It's pretty straightforward. And really it is. And it's a lot of stuff that you have to learn. But once you learn it, regardless of what product you're carrying, you're probably going to be successful. I love to think you're going to be successful. And that's why we do what we do.
So you hear rumors that it's all political, that master distributors are the only people who can get into these large chains, and they hire lobbyists to lobby the buyers. Is this a bunch of BS?
No. First, I think it's a bunch of BS that only major companies can get into Walmart. Yeah, that's definitely a bunch of BS. And I think what it is people who are making excuses. You hear that a lot. I'll never get into Walmart. I'm a little guy. They don't care about me, blah, 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 and so forth. Walmart has put a very unique process in place to make sure that the little guy can be successful at Walmart. However, they don't depart away from the critical merchandising standards and the critical process that you need to follow to be successful. So they're not going to depart their business model so that you're successful. They're going to say, look, if you've got a good item and it fits in this particular business model, then we want to hear about it. Here's a neat story. I had a guy call me about 3 days ago. He was young. He was in his 20s, and he lived up in the Northeast. And he said, hey, you know, I've been trying to get my product into Walmart, and they told me you're the person that can get it in there for me. And I said, well, you know, I don't really do that type of thing. I can give you information on how to get your product into Walmart. But
who told him that?
Employee using a sales ploy.
Oh, I see.
And I said, well, first of all, what's your product? And he said, well, it's really an idea. I said, oh, it's an idea. And he's like, yeah. And I said, what's your idea? He says, well, I'm a really good drawer, and a lot of people tell me I should make T-shirts. And I said, you should make T-shirts. And I said, what's your manufacturing capabilities? And he said, huh? And I said, if Walmart brought in one of your T-shirts tomorrow, could you supply them with 1,000 T-shirts if they wanted them right there? Well, no, because I was thinking about running off on that paper and ironing them on each T-shirt. But this is what we get.
Because most people are very clueless when it comes to business. They just have no idea.
Right. And so I tried to help the kid. Now, he didn't want to discourage him or anything like that. I said, listen, you know, get a track record on and so forth. But he'll walk away saying, well, this guy's telling me Walmart doesn't want to deal with me. Mm-hmm. And so that's the way those rumors will start getting spread. You get folk out there that really don't do their homework. Walmart tells you everything you need to do. Now just go do it. It's some pretty straightforward stuff.
You just have to get some education and have an understanding of how to do it.
Right. You know, I used to have a little saying years ago, a big wig would come work with it. Maybe the senior vice president of sales would come work with a sales rep. And that rep would call me the night before and says, you know, Lonnie, I don't know what to do. This guy's coming to work with me and blah, 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 and so forth. And I would always tell him, you can get your act together for one day. Because this could mean your career. And if you can't get your act together for one day, you have no business being in this business. That's the same thing with Walmart. You get an appointment, or any customer. Michael, you get an appointment with any customer, if you don't do a pre-call plan and spend the amount of time and hours that you need to getting ready for that call, then you don't deserve the business.
That one visit to Walmart could set you for life.
It could set you for life, yes, indeed. But the bottom line is, a lot of folks don't really get ready for that one call.
You got some stories in your mind where you've known the little guy or guys with dreams and ideas, and they've approached Walmart and literally become millionaires?
Well, I mean, look at the tortilla. In the tortilla category, you've got a couple companies. You've got Azteca Foods. They're your number two company. You've got Mission Foods, who's your number one company.
Where's Mission out of?
Mission's out of Dallas, Texas. They're based in Irving, Texas, which is right outside of Dallas. They're a $1 billion company, right? He started back in 1977 in the United States with nothing in terms of selling. He was very successful in Mexico, so he brought it over here. But the point I'm making is there was a guy named Don Barnes. Don Barnes Jr. graduated from North Carolina, came out of college. His dad was a pretty successful business person, too. He says to his dad, "Dad, you know what? I think I want to go into business for myself." And he said, "What are you going to make, son?" He said, "I don't know." Then he got to thinking. He said, "You know, there's a lot of Mexicans moving to North Carolina." He says, "I know they eat something." He says, "Wow, they eat corn tortillas." So Don Barnes got into the corn tortilla business. He opened up a plant and started baking corn tortillas. And a few years later, Mission came and bought him out for like $30, $40 million. I don't know what the figure was. But, I mean, here's a guy that started, and he was successful getting into Walmart. And there's a lot of small tortilla companies out there. There's Albuquerque Tortilla Company out in New Mexico. They were a small company that got into Walmart. There's a little small company out of Plainview, Texas called Costa Rica.
Let's say I'm a manufacturer in China or some other country, and I want to get my product here into the United States. Is Walmart looking for products from other countries, or are they loyal to America?
Walmart has three ways you can get into their stores. One way is you can be a manufacturer that sells a product here in the United States and you're going to sell it to all stores. Number two, you can be a manufacturer here in the United States and you're going to sell it to a few stores. And there's a process by which you do that. And then number three, you can be an importer. And by import, that's the manufacturer in China that wants to get their product into Walmart. And there's a buying office in China that they would go through to be able to get an audience here in the United States and present their product. Walmart's always looking for the right product.
Are buying offices set up all over the world?
Oh, yeah. They've got buying offices everywhere.
And is there like a Chinese office? They all speak Chinese there?
English as well. There are Americans in the Chinese office. Walmart has a buying office in Puerto Rico. Walmart has buying offices in Argentina.
How big is Walmart for someone who doesn't really understand the sheer size of this buying group?
Let's look at Walmart sales. Walmart had over $300 billion in sales last year, okay? If you look at their $300 billion sales and you make it equivalent to gross national product, that would make Walmart the ninth largest country in the world. If you equivalize that to gross national product. If you look at Walmart as a city with its 1.1 million employees in the United States, that would make it the fifth largest city in the United States. So that's one of the best ways you can look at Walmart. In terms of stores, they got well over 3,000 stores easily.
Just in the U.S.?
Just in the United States, right. And then they've got stores in Argentina, Mexico, Canada, Great Britain, Germany, China.
Can someone get a product into Walmart here in the U.S. and then it gets picked up in other countries?
Oh, yeah. We were trying to do that with the tortillas.
Let me ask you this. I've heard that you will not get into Walmart for some products. I'm sure it's not for everything unless you have a huge advertising budget, and they want advertising to support the sales of the product. And if I'm a small guy and I've got an idea and a product, but I don't have a $1 million advertising budget, is there really a chance for me?
No, that's not true. It's always a chance for you. There was a story about the girl who sold antenna balls to Walmart.
Tell me about that story.
Apparently some young lady decided to do a special type of antenna ball that you would recognize your car in the parking lot, and they were a huge hit at Walmart. She didn't have $1 million of this or $1 million of that. She didn't have all of this. She just had a good idea, and she got them manufactured. She got them brought on by Walmart.
Is Walmart loyal to their customers? So, for instance, let's say she came up with an antenna ball, and Walmart's buying them for $1.50. She's not patented. Some guy knocks it off, approaches the buyer at Walmart, and says, "Hey, I got these antenna balls, but I'll undercut what you're paying right now. I'll give them to you for $1." Is there any protection or loyalty to their existing customers where they're not just going to buy the guys because he can sell it for 50 cents less? I want the real world.
The real world answer. Walmart has certain standards for vendors. They publish those vendor standards. Supplier standards are what they call them. As long as you meet those supplier standards, if you come with a cheaper mousetrap, Walmart's going to buy it.
They are.
Oh, yeah. Walmart's going to buy it if it's a cheaper mousetrap, but it offers the same quality or better than what they're currently carrying, they're going to carry.
Okay, so let's stop right there. So let's say someone's looking to get into Walmart, and they're looking for opportunity. Can I go to Walmart, go to a category, go look at products, and ask myself, how can I beat this product? How can I make this product better? How can I get it to Walmart cheaper? Is there a possibility for me to get in that way?
Yeah.
Just do it better, cheaper?
If you can do it better and cheaper, you definitely can get into Walmart. You say better, just quality. Yeah, the same quality or better. You can get into Walmart.
Is that a slam dunk?
Is that a slam dunk? No, nothing's a slam dunk with Walmart. But it's very attractive.
That's a good strategy.
It's a wonderful strategy if you can do it. Walmart looks at a company like this. They say, look, first of all, you have to have the wherewithal. That means the financials and whatever to be able to support the product that you're making.
All right, well, let's talk about that. Let's say if I don't have the money and I go to a buyer and he says, I like it. We're going to go into 300 stores. Here's your PO. Can I take that PO and get money?
I have known people to do that.
How much of a barrier not having the money to support Walmart purchase orders? Is that a barrier or are there ways around it?
It is a barrier because number one, Walmart's going to look at your financials before they let you on as the supplier.
Before they give me a PO?
Well, before they get a PO, they're going to look at your financials.
Well, what if I don't have the money? What's the strategy for me to get around that?
I would get the money. Because Walmart's not going to be in the money fronting business. It's like we'll bring you in and we'll front you the money by buying the product.
At what point are they looking at money? After I meet with a buyer?
Well, it's hard to say. See, what happens is once they want to see you, they allow you to fill out the supplier form to become a supplier at Walmart. And when you fill that out, it has all the company financials. You've got to give them a D&B. And you know what a D&B, what it's going to do. If you don't have a D&B, you're not going to get into Walmart. You know, Dun & Bradstreet report. Give them a Dun & Bradstreet report.
So,
if you don't have that, you're not going to get into Walmart.
So does that mean you have to be a corporation?
Even if you're a family-owned operation, you're still a corporation. But if you're a sole proprietorship and you haven't disclosed your financials for Dun & Bradstreet, you're not going to get into Walmart.
Okay. Because you're going to have to fill out a vendor application with financials.
We'll see, as a part of the online vendor application process, they click there and say, okay, now you need to obtain your D&B report. And then Walmart obtains that D&B report from Dun & Bradstreet. You don't give it to them, they obtain it. And they charge you like $75 to do it or whatever the case is. I forget how much exactly it is. But they already have that information on file.
For someone who doesn't know what a D&B is, explain it to them.
Well, Dun & Bradstreet is just your credit rating. It just tells you what type of company you are, what kind of money you have, what kind of resources you have. That's essentially what a Dun & Bradstreet report is. If you're going to do business with someone, it's always good to pull a D&B on to find out exactly what kind of company they are, what kind of leadership they have, what kind of capacity, because remember, you're dependent upon your suppliers.
I'm sure there's a lot of people who have ideas and have products, maybe have bad credit, and don't have a D&B. Can you give me a strategy of a way to get around that and still give me the possibility of getting my product in? Could I approach someone who's already in Walmart and offer them to carry the product who already has good credit and a good D&B?
Well, I think so. It depends on what you're selling. Number one, it has to fit those tests that we already talked about. Does it make sense for the category? Number two, you have to find a company that have a related item. And essentially what you're doing is you're signing the whole product over to the other company.
Doesn't that sound like an easier way to go is find someone who's already an established vendor and maybe work a deal and sell them the product?
Well, it's always an easier way to go, but then what you're doing now is you're selling to people. Because number one, you got to sell someone on buying the product from you to be able to resell it into Walmart.
Double-edged sword.
Yeah, exactly. It's not very difficult, but there's a lot of work involved in this. And also, for instance, say Walmart represents 30% or less of your business. That's okay. Walmart gets nervous when they represent more than 30% of your business.
Why is that?
Well, because if Walmart should happen to go to another vendor, you're out of business.
Why should they worry about that?
Well, there's still a public relations piece.
Do they want to know that you have other business going?
They've asked me from time to time to supply my other customers and what I do with my other customers. Now, I didn't supply that information to them, but I did tell them, look, you only represent 15% of my business or whatever the case is, and they should leave it alone at that
point. All right, so what do you have right now going with Walmart?
I work for another company that has a product that's in Walmart, and so that's why I have to remain confidential.
Okay. Can you tell me what category it is?
It's tortillas still. Yeah, I still do tortillas.
What do you call that category, the tortilla category?
Well, you call it tortilla category, but in Walmart, it's part of commercial bread.
Okay. So you work for a company that has the tortillas in there?
Yes, they have their tortillas in there. And so I'm helping them out. I worked for a larger tortilla company. Now this is a much smaller tortilla company. We do okay because we have a good understanding of how we operate at Walmart. I tell people, too, I say, listen, if you've got a new product idea and it's a food item, it's always easier to me to get a food item in than to get an electronic gadget or whatever.
Why is it?
Everybody consumes foods. See, Walmart has a deal called Store the Community. And what that means is they like to carry items that particular geography really likes and really wants to have.
All right, let's say you got someone who grows wonderful produce in a local area.
What I mean by this is, let's say you have a small tortilla company, and for 100 years you've lived in this one little area and you've made this wonderful tortilla. A lot of people love this tortilla in this particular marketplace, and Walmart's got 10 stores in this area. You're going to find that tortilla in those 10 stores because it's part of the community.
And what do we call that program?
It's called Store the Community Program.
So they want to support local vendors.
They want to support local vendors that have a huge following in that market.
Because it's good money and it gets people into their store.
It's good money and it's good PR as well.
Do they have special buyers looking for that local community?
Every buyer looks for Store the Community. It's not special buyers. Every buyer has a responsibility to make sure they have the right product mix in every store. And if you're in a particular area and there's a chocolate company, for instance, and they make these great chocolates and they're in every other store in this area, you want to make sure that you're buying that product as well. Same with potato chips. Gosh, there's so many different snack companies out there, but some of them have huge followings. For instance, in Chicago, there's J. Jay's potato chips.
I'm sure Jay's is in the Chicago area Walmart.
Oh, without a doubt.
So let's stop right there, because every time you talk, I want to look for opportunities for the people listening to this recording.
Right.
So look for stars in your community who aren't in Walmart and see if you can approach those manufacturers as a commission sales person and get the rights to go to Walmart.
You can do that. Here's a neat little story. I know a guy that makes a meat rub in Garland, Texas, and I approached him not too long ago, and I said, you know what? You really should market this meat rub, because everybody loves it. It was written up in the Dallas Morning News. It's just an outstanding meat rub. It doesn't have a UPC on it or anything like that. And I said, Dave, you should really market this thing at Walmart. And he said, you know what? I'm really going to think about that, but I have to get a UPC first. Of course, I showed him how to get a UPC and all those types of things.
But real quick, what is a UPC?
Universal Product Code. It's the barcode that goes on every product. You have to have one if you do business with Walmart. You have to have a barcode.
Okay, so they can scan it.
It's not a matter of you getting to your laser jet printer and printing off labels with a barcode on it.
No, there's a process.
Right, you have to be registered with the Uniform Product Council.
Can you show someone how to do this process?
Yeah, that's part of the seminars that we put on as well. We show them how to get a UPC code. But getting a UPC is based upon the size and sales of your company. And so if you're a small company, it's not going to cost you a lot of money to get a UPC.
All right, so you told him to get a UPC code. What did he say then?
He said, that's something I want to look into. He said, but I don't know if I want to be that large. So here he has an item that was written up in the Dallas Morning News. I think what he was saying to me, though, Michael, is I don't have time to do it. I'm waiting for someone to do it. Now, the reason I didn't say I'd do it for him is because I'm just a consumer of the product, and I just enjoy the product, and I'm kind of selfish, too, because I've always felt that when you find something really, really good, if I don't represent it as a salesperson, if I'm using it as a user, the more mass appeal it gets, the more diluted the product is.
Right. He may have also thought, I don't have the money to get into Walmart, and had some of those automatic fears and objections that come in their mind based on irrelevant information.
And that could have been it as well. What Walmart's looking for, again, from a manufacturer is, number one, do you have the wherewithal to be in business? And do you have the manufacturing capabilities to supply what we're looking for? And if you've got that, it's fine. And so you don't have to have $10 million in the bank to do that. You might only have $200. But if you've got the manufacturing capabilities and you're not deep in debt, you're going to be fine. And then, of course, you've got to get your liability insurance. And once you get your liability insurance, you're fine. You're gravy. But there's a couple things I want to talk about. First was the VPI program, volume producing item. Every buyer takes a certain item that they can use to drive business. Now, it used to be called the volume producing item program, which is VPI. Now it's called the value producing item program. It's the same acronym, but it's just a different meaning behind it. What it does mean is that every buyer wants to get an item that they can really take this item and they can build this item and it can really have a huge, tremendous positive impact on category sales. Now, the criteria behind the value producing program used to be that it was an item that wasn't in distribution. You see?
Yeah.
It's an item that was not currently in distribution at Walmart.
So a totally unique item.
It's a totally unique item.
Can you give me an example of one in the past that you could relate this to?
Well, let's look at this. Someone had a VPI item called pom-poms, P-O-M-P-O-M, in their paper towels, and they were sold at Sam's. And they hadn't been in distribution before.
What's a pom-pom? What is it?
Paper towel.
Is it unique?
It's an industrial paper towel.
Okay.
It's for food service and those types of things. And so it was a unique item at that point. And someone had that as their VPI. But also, though, remember, it says it has not been in distribution. So, for instance, someone could have picked cherry vanilla Coke because it wasn't in distribution. It's kind of cheating, but it wasn't in distribution.
You're telling me each category manager needs to pick a VPI?
Each category manager doesn't need to. They do.
They do pick one.
Yeah. They're very competitive about these VPI items.
When they choose the VPI, what are they saying? They say, this is my VPI.
It's the item that I'm going to build this year. Here's a small item, or here's another item that wasn't in distribution last year, and I'm going to put a huge amount of effort behind building this item this year.
And the buyer's saying this?
The buyer's saying this, yes.
What kind of effort can they put in to build it other than getting it in more stores?
They can get it in stores. They can get it on a rollback program.
What's a rollback program?
Where they roll the price back like 10%.
Okay.
And a 20% rollback. Temporary price reduction. They can get it in Action Alley, which is that big aisle with a bunch of pallets in it at Walmart.
Oh, Action Alley?
They call that Action Alley, yeah. And Action Alley was typically between where the general merchandise and the food areas come together.
So that's a high-volume moving aisle.
That's a high-volume moving aisle, right. They can get it in there. They can tell the stores to push that item, you know, and they can get additional off-shelf displays.
And they want to do this because they want to build their category.
They want to build their category, and in turn, they're building the brand. They're building this new item.
And as they build the brand, it becomes more popular and hopefully will be a long-lasting revenue generator. generating brand for Walmart.
Exactly. And this item also fills a glaring need that's being unmet in the category.
All right, so those pom-pom paper towels, for instance, that was an industrial paper towel. It had never been on the shelves.
I don't know. All I know is that that item was the VPI for one of the big muckety mucks over at Sam's. Now, a version of that could have been on the shelf, but this particular one did. Do you know those orange buckets you can get at Home Depot?
Yes.
Someone picked yellow buckets or orange buckets like that. They sold them for like a dollar at Walmart.
And they just must have sold billions of them.
They sold a whole bunch of them. The bottom line, though, is it's just all a matter of numbers, too. If they sold 25 million buckets, that means they only made $25 million from that VPI item. Imagine if you took a food item that retailed at $3 and you sold 25 million units of that food product.
Yeah, the consumable is much more profitable.
No, I don't think so. But what I'm saying is,
in the long run, because of the consumability,
yeah.
Do you see them going after consumer-related products that are consumable for VPIs compared to one-time sales, like a bucket?
Well, yeah, every buyer has it. So, for instance, if you buy tortillas, you can't pick a bucket. You have to pick something that you buy. So you're going to pick a tortilla company, you know, one of their items that really push. If you buy pastries, you're going to pick a pastry company.
All right, I want to relate it back to me, the guy who wants to get into Walmart, and I want to relate it to strategy. So when I'm coming up with a product, whether I'm going in there looking for a competitive edge on an existing product or whether I'm going to source and manufacture my own product, keep in mind when I'm talking to the buyer that maybe I could pitch my product as one of their VPIs and give reasons why this would be a good one for them.
That's correct, yes.
Okay, good strategy?
That's correct. Personally, I think Store the Community and VPR are some of the best strategies you can employ to get into Walmart. Because number one, Store the Community helps you get started, and there is a governor to it. And what I mean by that is you're not going to get a purchase order tomorrow for 1,000 stores.
When you get into Walmart, they're going to test it and be cautious, right?
No, they may not. You might have some hemp doormats that are retail for 78 cents, and they'll move like crazy, and they'll put them in every one of their stores around the country.
But the buyers know that a product like that is going to move.
Yeah, I think they're going to be measured at first. Most buyers are measured. You know, that's happened to me on some of the tortilla items that I've sold in the past. They said, let's start out in these stores, and then we'll see how it does, and then we'll move from there.
All right, let's talk about money. I'm a manufacturer. I get an order for 1,000 stores in Walmart. I got to finance everything until I'm paid. How long am I going to wait till I get my money?
Walmart pays their bills. If you follow their process, whatever your terms are, they're going to pay within those terms.
Who sets the terms, me or the buyer?
The manufacturer sets what your payment terms are.
So when you go into Walmart and they want your product, you should say, look, I'm a smaller manufacturer. I can handle getting into stores, but I need net 30. Is that realistic?
That's realistic.
So Walmart will sometimes pay net 30?
They're going to pay net 30. They're going to pay whatever your terms are. Because Walmart doesn't like your terms, they'll let you know up front, we don't like those terms.
Something that I always believed, which may be totally untrue, is that Walmart will make you wait 6 months for your money or 9 months for your money.
That is untrue. Walmart has a list of expectations for suppliers, and they also have a list of supplier expectations of them. And one of them is you can expect as a supplier you will get paid and you will get paid on time.
See, that's great. That's a misconception I think a lot of people believe.
It's a huge misconception.
Where do you think that comes from?
It comes from the fact that what happens is Walmart is very automated. And what will happen is you might not be automated. He asks you for different documentation that you were supposed to have and you didn't supply that documentation.
And that's what holds everything up.
It holds everything up.
Because right. You haven't followed directions as a vendor.
For instance, EDI, Electronic Data Interchange. All orders at Walmart are pretty much EDI orders. They're transmitted electronically back and forth.
Tell me what that is. Explain it to me.
EDI is a way that we transmit orders. It's computer-based. And what we do is we take the order and we electronically send that order. It's not an email. It's an electronic format that's readable on the other end. And once that order is received, it actually kicks into motion a series of things.
But let's say you're brand gets a purchase order from Walmart. That's the order you're talking about?
Yes, it'll be electronically transmitted to me.
Are you given a website as a vendor to go in to get those orders?
Actually, the larger companies don't have a website because the computers talk directly to each other.
Do you have to have a special computer?
No. There's companies out there that can help and enable you with EDI technology.
Can you help someone with that in your consulting on how to get all that set up?
Oh, yeah. Without a doubt, we point out those companies. I've done some of that type of stuff in the past as well.
All right, so this is no big deal. You first got to get your order, and you better make sure when a PO comes in, they're not going to call you and fax it to you.
No, it will be sent to you in some format electronically, and you will respond back to them in some format electronically.
Okay, letting them know you received the order.
Yeah, through EDI, all that is automated process and takes care of it, and there are companies who are go-betweens that help you become EDI, and so it's not peer-to-peer. You EDI to a hub, and that hub to that company, and then that company EDIs whoever you need EDI for. It's electronic, and there's companies out there that'll help you. Walmart believes in flow. float.
What's float?
It's a really interesting concept. Years ago, there was a story, and I don't know if the story is true or not, Michael, but I'm going to assume it was true. Years ago, there was a story about Pampers, if I'm not mistaken, and about how Walmart was taking a loss on Pampers, yet making money on Pampers. What they were doing is they were selling them below cost, yet they were making money on Pampers. And they were saying, well, wait a minute, how can you sell something at cost yet make money on it? Well, what Walmart was doing is they were turning the Pampers so fast that they were floating the cash, and they were making money on the interest. They even had to pay the bill. And that's a whole concept about cash float, fast nickel, and slow dime, and that type of stuff. It's just like Walmart when they make a few pennies. One company might make 10 cents on something. Walmart make only one penny on it. But Walmart might sell 100 times what that other company sells in a short time frame.
So isn't that why they would really want to take as long as they can to pay you?
No, not necessarily, because when we're talking turning 30 days in supermarket, oh gosh, that's a lifetime. You could turn a product 10 times in those 30 days.
Well, do you think you're 30 days because you're a tortilla compared to a plastic manufactured product? Do you think it may be different with the different categories?
Yeah, I think so.
So your category, 30 days, is okay. But you say there may be some categories where a manufacturer can expect to wait 90 days to 6 months.
Again, you stipulate your requirements up front.
And if they don't like it, they'll tell you.
Yeah, if they don't like it, they'll tell you. And then you don't have to do business with them if you don't like what they tell you. And that's what I tell a lot of people, too, when they talk to me. I'm like, look, the company has their policies. And their policy is what it is. But by and large, I've never heard of anyone not being dealt fairly when it comes to getting paid. I just never heard of it. And I've been up here for a number of years. And I've never seen anyone walking away from home office grumbling. I've never been to a meeting where a bunch of people came out against Walmart. The bottom line is, when you get Walmart, you've got one of the best partners in the industry that you can have.
I think the media has really done a number on them and painted them as the big bad, big brother.
Well, they've done a terrible job with Walmart and beat them up pretty badly. And the bottom line here, Michael, is that I am a consumer and I have children and I have a family. And what's interesting is we had this conversation the other night at the kitchen table, me and a bunch of my sisters and brothers and in-laws and whatever, we were talking about Walmart.
They saved American family money.
Yeah.
That's my position, too.
Money that we can spend elsewhere or money that we can choose to save. But the bottom line is they save us money.
Yeah, we don't have to shop there. You want to go spend more money, go somewhere else.
If you go to Kroger or Albertsons without their loyalty card, you're going to take a killing. I don't need a loyalty card at Walmart. I just go and shop, and I save money every day. I saw an interesting article a couple days ago in the Business Journal. Every city has their Business Journal. I was reading the Business Journal for the city that I live in now, and I saw an article about gas stations. And the way the reporter wrote the article was kind of slanted, because he said a lot of these Kroger and Giant Eagle and all these guys, they have these incentive programs where if you buy X amount of groceries from them, you get a discount on the gas that they sell you. And they said, but Walmart doesn't discount their gas for their customers. And I said, well, that's not true. Walmart discounts their gas for everybody. They offer discounted gas. You don't necessarily have to be a Walmart customer, but it's at a discounted price. So I don't have to have a card to buy gas from Walmart and receive a discount.
All right, Walmart's one company. Have you had experience in other mass retailers and are things similar, or are there a lot of differences?
Well, there's a lot of differences. I've dealt with Target at one point in my life. I've dealt with Costco and a few other ones out there.
What other large chains would you tell a international manufacturer, maybe importer, to definitely look at if they don't have success with Walmart?
I always tell them to look at all of them. Even look at Kroger, Albertsons, Safeway. Look at those guys as well. If you're going to sell a product, you might as well sell it to everybody or try. Because a lot of times what Walmart will require is that you have a track record. So we need a track record. And it's like, well, I don't have a track record. But it's always easy to sell your product if you have a track record than if you don't. So you might get picked up by one of these guys. And again, it's kind of a double-edged sword, too, because you might go in to see Safeway and they say, does Walmart have it? And you say, well, no. And they say, well, I don't know why we want to carry it. Or they might say, does Walmart have it? And you say, yeah. And they say, well, we want to carry something Walmart carries. We're trying to differentiate ourselves from that or run us out of business.
Let's say Walmart places an order for your widget. It goes in, and those sales records are meticulously kept. They're shared by other large retailers, so Costco may see a hot item in Walmart. Can't they subscribe to that data?
Walmart doesn't release their data to any syndicated data services. You're talking about AC Nielsen data or IRI data, information resources data, which tells how a product is selling in a particular market or chain.
Right, so Walmart isn't involved with that?
Walmart doesn't release their data like that, no. Now, you can release your internal data to anyone and say, I'm selling this product and I do have it available at Walmart, and here's the growth of this product. Not necessarily at Walmart, but here's the growth of this product. That's fine.
I'm saying for the guy who doesn't have a track record, so let's say I get it into Kroger's, who uses IRI data, and we have a lot of success in Kroger's. There's other companies who subscribe to that IRI data, because all these other buyers are looking for hot products. Aren't they reviewing IRI data?
Yeah, there's a report in the category management called an Items Not Carried report. And what that does is that looks at the items that are in the market in comparison with the items that you carry. And then what it does, it takes out those items that you don't carry and says, okay, here are these items. items. And then what it does, it kind of puts a predictive model together, say, if you carry this item, this is the type of sales that you could expect. And so if it was attracted, they look at it and say, well, yeah, we should probably carry that item. And they bring that item in distribution. So that's where you're looking at the IRI data, and you get a track record. And, yeah, other retailers are seeing that. But see, let me explain one quick area also, just to help you out with items. If you have an item that's environmentally friendly, run. Do not walk to Walmart.
Tell me why.
Environmental sustainability is what they like to call it, but really what it means is that we need to be good stewards of this earth. There are going to be 8 billion people on the face of this earth here pretty darn quickly, and all this stuff has to go somewhere. So Walmart is looking at items that are made from recycled papers. They're looking at items where the packaging has been reduced. They're looking at items that are made from organic cotton. They're looking at items that are printed with non-toxic inks. They're looking for items that are biodegradable, you know, compostable, all those types of things they're looking for. Because environmental sustainability is a huge, huge push for Walmart right now. They're looking at items that are being made with renewable fuels.
They have a responsibility. They want to do better for the world, right?
Exactly. And also, with that in mind, for instance, Walmart's replacing light bulbs in their stores, and they're saving millions of dollars by doing it. And when they replace it, they're going from like a regular tungsten type of light bulb to a fluorescent type, for instance. When they look at that and they say, okay, here's our annual electricity savings, so they'll say that. But they take it a step further, Michael. They'll say, okay, here's how much coal we didn't have to use, so we saved the environment from crap being spit into the environment. They take it all the way back to the manufacturer. So what I tell folks is, look, if you've got an item that's eco-friendly, run, do not walk to Walmart. If you've got an item that's going to offer better packaging in recycled paper or whatever, just run, don't walk to Walmart. That is one of the easiest ways right now I think you can get into Walmart is with an item that you can put on the grocery shelf that still has a clear benefit, a clear point of differentiation than the rest of the items on the shelf, but also it has a benefit to the environment.
All right, that's a great strategy too.
It's a huge strategy. I wish I could slap people right now and say, hey guys, here's a great opportunity, but also make it affordable.
Okay, well, here's an idea. You know, the idea about going into a category, looking on the shelves, looking what's there and trying to do something better. You can look at existing commodity-type products and repackage it environmentally friendly and take over the product.
Right, you can do that. Or you can also approach some of the companies that are in there and say, look, I can show you how to print your packaging on non-toxic inks. Walmart creates opportunity for everybody. Also, Michael, there's a program Walmart has. It's not just for if you want to be a supplier for an item for resale. You can be a supplier for Walmart for an item for Walmart to consume.
Tell me more about that.
That means Walmart buys paper towels every day to use themselves. Walmart buys cleaning items to use themselves. Now remember, you're coming in the door with a new eco-friendly cleaning item that you can use to clean all the Walmart stores, or a new light bulb. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
You could sell that item directly to Walmart, not for resale, but being one of their suppliers for the stuff that they consume themselves. So that's another way to get into Walmart, too.
You're going to be putting on seminars, and you're going to help importers, and you're going to help manufacturers have a better chance and a higher probability of getting their products successfully into Walmart. You've got over 15 years of experience. What are we going to learn in your seminars if we were to hire you or to look for more information on this, other than what we've talked about today? Have we just touched the surface today?
You've just touched the surface. How can we help them? What we do is we help you get prepared for that ultimate goal to meet in front of Walmart. Walmart has a very well-ordered published process out there. Anyone can go to www.walmartstores.com, and right there will tell you how to become a Walmart supplier. And I really wish it was that easy. And so what we do is we take that piece and we take it three steps further. So we say, okay, here's the process of becoming a Walmart supplier. We'll help you with the published process. That's meaning here's how you get your proposition together. Here's how you get all this information together for this proposal. We then take you to the non-published process. There are other ways to get in touch with buyers. There are other things that you need to do. I walk you through how to go to a store and how to identify a need. How do you know if you have a right product? I walk you through how do you obtain a DMV? How do you obtain a UPC? How do you become a minority certified business?
Tell me about that.
Walmart, again, has criteria for everybody. Now, if you're a women's owned business or if you're a minority business enterprise and you still fulfill the same criteria as anybody else does in terms of having the wherewithal and the manufacturing capabilities and so on and so forth, Walmart is going to take a very positive view of helping you out. They really do help out minority owned businesses. Now, again, all they do is they put everybody on an equal level playing field. And what they say is, okay, look, I've got an item over here that's an excellent item that's being made by a company XYZ. I've got the same item over here that's going to be made by this minority business enterprise. It's an excellent item. It offers the same benefits, attributes to my customer. Walmart's going to look towards helping the minority business enterprise out and get up and get going. It's the same product or maybe even better. And so that can help you get in. So if you're a certified minority business enterprise or if you're a certified women's business enterprise, and what I mean by certified, you've got to get certified, and we'll show you how to become certified by walking you through the certification process. And again, it's a difficult process as well because the WBENC, that's the Women's Business Enterprise Council, they're good partners of many corporations in the United States. So they're going to have tough criteria for you to become certified. They're just not going to give their certification to anybody. And that's the same with the Minority Business Enterprise, the MBE. They're going to make sure that you live up to that certification process, or they're not going to give it away as well. So we walk you through that process. We walk you through the back-end process, things like understanding Bentonville, understanding the Walmart culture. What does the 10-foot rule mean?
What is the 10-foot rule?
The 10-foot rule means whenever a customer gets within 10 foot of any associate, the associate's supposed to smile and greet them. Sam's rules of merchandise. There's all different things that are out there that come to play, and we help you with those things. And additionally, what we do is we help you find different strategies. For instance, the process of Walmart says, take all this information, and then you go online, you fill out this thing, submit it, and then if this organization believes that you should be here, they'll turn your name over to a buyer. That's the way it works. Well, you know, what I do is I get my proposition together, and I get on the phone and find out who my buyer is, and I call the buyer. And I call them direct and say, hey, I got blah, 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 and I was referred to by blah, 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 blah. And I'd help you with all of that. And see, if a buyer wants something, the buyer will bring you in, and then what happens is then instead of you having to wait for this committee that gets your proposal, I think it's called supplier development. Then waiting for supplier development to send the paperwork over, they already have the paperwork, and they send information to supplier development and say, look, we're dealing with these people here.
So you're going to give me step by step, you're going to hold my hand, you're going to give me the support, you're going to give me the tools. You're going to give me the resources to show me how to get my product in.
The only thing I'm not going to do is take you to Bentonville and make that presentation for you. I'll even help you prepare the presentation, but I'm not going to go to Bentonville and I'm not going to make that presentation for you. There are companies that will do that for you, and they'll do it for a fee. And here's my thing on this whole fee-based thing. There are companies out there that charge as much as 5% of gross sales for X amount of years to get your product into Walmart and help represent you. And, you know, I see people do this, and sometimes they're successful and sometimes they're not. If they're not successful, the company obviously doesn't get anything, which is fair, obviously. But if they are successful, the company gets 5% of their gross. Well, they give 5% of their gross away, they can't buy any other support services that they need. For instance, say you're a food company, and you get your product into Walmart. Somebody needs to be able to touch that product for you, so you need some kind of representation in the store. There are brokerage firms that represent you, and they charge 2, 3, 4% to do that. You need to spend that money to those companies that will help you with that product in the store, paying that 2, 3, 4% there. And you've already spent it up front trying to get into Walmart. My thing is, if you've got a sound proposition, you've done a tremendous amount of homework, I think ultimately you're going to be successful getting in the door in Walmart.
So are you saying beware, there are a lot of wolves out there trying to take advantage of people who have the dream of getting their product into Walmart?
That's true in anything, and I don't know if I want to call them wolves, and I don't know if I want to say they're taking advantage. I just think if I were doing it, I would not use a company to help me get into Walmart that's going to charge me a percent of my gross sales. I don't understand that. I would latch on to a brokerage company or a sales and marketing agency that could help my product sell every day at a store level. And that's how I would invest my funds. So what we do is we just take a flat fee up front, then you're done with us. That's what we do. And I mean, that's just our business model, and I think it's fair.
So, Ronnie, if someone wants to talk to you about getting their product into Walmart and to kind of look at some of the services you offer, how can they get in touch with you by phone?
Well, they can reach me at 360-525-0208.
360-525-0208.
That's correct. Well, they can reach me at 360-525-0208.
360-525-0208.